This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on remote. Ray Armantrout has just returned from Australia. She's with us today, and we're going to hear an opening poem from her new book. Here's Ray.
Thanks, Grace. This is the first poem in my new book, Go Figure, from Wesleyan. Here I go, one. Here I go again. Was a rock anthem once. Crowds on their feet, mouthing the words. Two. There's no way to explain how faultlessly I want to write about how pointless all this is. Nothing I can point to but the gesture itself, the way it comes to seem anachronistic, spectral, like this ongoing attempt to catalog the world by latching each thing to the last memory it calls up. Nothing recalls the new Cat 6 Haboob. Three, but I'm hard to discourage when a branch lays out five like an old card trick, identical white orchids, three-petaled light sails spread, ready to go, each with a small bat face in the middle.
Ray Armantrout, and what is the title of this book?
Go Figure.
Well, it has the same Armantrout energy that we know about your previous books, where you have sparks of energy that come off the page because of the way you put those words together, and then the way you compress space between those words. I'm on to you. So how do you describe it? That's how I describe it.
Well, I love the term compressed space. When I taught, I would always tell my students that they could get a lot of power out of what I called compression, actually.
Oh.
Yeah, like I said that, you know, with metaphor, that with as with fissile material, you know, when you have radioactive particles, the closer they get to each other, the more they interact. So you have to press.
There you go. There's your juxtaposition. We are on to your secret. And so let us continue together. Do you want to read two at once and set them up, or do you like to do them singly? We could do two at once because we can take a breath between. We want to get a good sense of your voice because this is Ray Armantrout. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're from the Library of Congress on remote.
Okay, so I'll read two poems then.
That would be great.
All right.
While you're getting ready, I have to say that the critics are really praising this. And one said, a welcoming balm for uncertain times. I want people to remember that as they listen to you.
Okay. Let me just say that I don't know if it's a balm. I'm glad he thought so, but a lot of it is kind of disturbing. Well, anyway, here we go. You see what you think. Skid. Sleep is my boyfriend, my mother, my boss. It tells me disjointed stories, news of the night world. I am walking on the fragile bodies of dolls. No, I'm not. It's something else. A sentimental journey through a doomsday scenario. Then we're back with the anger reenactors hired to grease the skids. And, okay, this one is quite different in tone. It was in Scientific American, actually. They have a poetry column, oddly. I have an interest in science. So anyway, it's a little poem called Fractal. Fractal. If I were made of homunculi, the way a cauliflower head is made of little noggins, would I be gorgeous like this green one? Field of rockets, each nippled with hard cones.
Ray Armantrout has published more than 18 books of poetry. So I'm interested, and everyone else is, in how you came to express yourself in this inimitable way. You trust your reader. You trust us. You say that the reader's imagination is equal to your imagination. Do you agree with that?
Well, you're right. The word trust is important. I don't know You know, I don't know who's going to read these poems, and I don't know how they'll be received, but I know that I wouldn't be interested if I wasn't saying it the way I wanted to say it. If I wasn't, you know, if I already knew what I was going to say when I got to the end, how the poem was going to fall out completely, I wouldn't do it. I'd be bored. So the poem has to take some, be at least be ready or be willing to take some unexpected turns and jags. And I find readers who want to stay with me, it seems.
So you just do it to please yourself.
Well, I mean, I'm glad to be read. No, obviously, I'm glad to be here and I'm glad to be read. And I'm glad
you have a huge audience because your book, Wobble, was a finalist for the National Book Award in 2018. And then in 2010, Verst won the National Book Critics Award and the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. Not bad, having two at once. Pretty yeah. Nice. So I'm wondering what Ray Armantrout was as a little girl.
Oh, well, okay. I was an only child. I was from a sort of a working class family in a kind of new suburb, you know, in the 50s when they were building these sort of ersatz Levittown type suburbs. So I was in a, you know, kind of isolated situation. My mother worked as well as my father, so my grandmother stayed with us, but she didn't say much really. So fortunately, I learned to read, so I started reading really early, and language became very important to me. And I also started to make up, writings, poems, to make notes. And I found out that I could keep myself from being lonely, you know, by writing down my thoughts in a way.
But did you sort of understand the world better by language? I mean, isn't that kind of the way you decoded things? And I think writers have that special wish to decipher the world with words that other people don't have. As a little girl, can you hark back and remember that? I can.
I cannot remember. I'm an honest person. I cannot remember when I was a tiny girl, no, but I do very much identify with that now. I don't know why I wrote back then except to keep myself company. And maybe by the time I was 12, you know what, by the time I wasn't tiny, but by the time I was 12, I was trying to figure everything out by writing it down. Not in poems, but my mother was religious and I was going back and forth about it. And I would write down in one column reasons that God should exist, and in another column reasons that whatever couldn't exist. And
that would not make a bad Armantrout poem today.
I think those questions and those ideas have come into some of my poems. Yeah,
indeed. Yeah. But I think somebody told you were pretty smart someplace along the way, because every one of us seems to have had a teacher that says, you know, you are real and you are worth something. I think that happened to you.
Well, yeah, that did. I had a teacher in first or second grade. Her name was Miss Sam Plusky, and she was interested in poetry, I think. She was having all the students write poems, and she would, this was before Xerox, so she would mimeograph them and make little booklets out of them. And she certainly did praise me and for it, and it made me, you know, feel like doing more, feel good about myself.
Well, let's read a poem for Miss Sam Plusky, wherever she is.
Yes. Okay. Well, this is kind of appropriate because this next poem, Fortune, starts out when I was a child, and also towards the end it gets into reading fairy tales to my granddaughters now. Mm-hmm. So anyway, okay. Fortune. One. It could have started like this. My mother took me to fabric shops when I was a kid. I would wander through the tall bolt days reading fortunes in the colors. Two. White. Paper mache of the mock orange flower on its many stems. Lavender as an afterthought, necrotic, carried interest. Ochre, like sunset in L.A., like dehydration. The popular mauve gray, which blends indifference with innocence. 3. One is chosen above her sisters. One tells a troll to eat his brothers. And Kemp gives one the power to spin yellow into patronage. One frills a frill again and again, no in order, no as if.
Yellow as in patronage. The thing about I understand is that I actually experience your poetry. I don't read it. I don't stand outside of it and look at it. When you read Ray Armantrout, you actually enter into that and experience it. And that is the difference. And that is why energy on the page is what works in language. And this is what you have unconsciously or somewhere along the line, you have channeled that knowledge so that you just trust your way of putting your things together and just trusting that they will bang in the right way. And that's my astute opinion about you. And I do think that you must wonder what people think about this new book. You must think, I wonder what they will remember or what poem they will remember or what they will feel. Do you have that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I know the poems that I like best, the poems that I've chosen to read today, I think
that's
are the ones that
I... good indication.
Yeah. But in reviews, I see, and there have been about 5 reviews, I see people picking out different poems to talk about, and not always these poems, other poems that meant something to them. And you never can tell about that, really. You have your own take on it, but other people take it somewhere else.
They might say, well, she still got it.
I hope so.
That'll be good. I'll take that.
Right. I think that's a good point because I do think, and it's only natural, I do think that the emerging poets get a lot of attention, but, you know, sometimes people just want, they don't just forget about us oldsters. They want to forget, I think. At least for a while, they want to put us to the side, and you know, sometimes we're still cooking.
Ray, there's nothing newer than your poetry. No one younger than your poetry. Believe me, you're on the cutting edge. They better run fast. I have to say, I am kind of interested in how you taught, because here you know how to be so inimitable, people can take it or leave it. And your whole career has rewarded that. As you say, honest. It's a good way to describe your work. You don't apologize for it. This is, you are honestly who you are. So how did you get your students to know that they had to be themselves more than anything else on the page? How did you actually teach that?
Yeah, that's really a hard thing to teach. Students are so inundated in the last decades even with media and social media and computers. And now it would be chatbot, which is even worse, that it's very hard for them, I think, to break through all that. And one thing I have done was tell them to just go out somewhere quiet and sit with a page and not just be in their own head, but look at the world, look around, watch things, see what interests them, see what moves them. Because most of my poems, I mean, this sounds kind of traditional, and I know I'm not really all that traditional, but most of my poems start with something that I saw or something that I heard out in the world, out in the street, on the street, or, you know, by looking at trees or listening to people, or starts that way. And then the sparks start flying and connecting.
No question about that. You actually are tethered to reality, and you always do it with image or sound. That is very clear. Let's hear a poem.
Oh, okay. Conversations. Push on it again, that point of light. What do you think light is? What is anything? If you aren't telling kids how to live in a world you can't imagine, what are you doing? Telling God about fall's claret-colored leaves? Touch me like you do the foliage.
You're a traveling woman. I know you must miss teaching, but what were you doing in Australia?
Well, I was invited to a university, Australia National University in Canberra, and I did several events. I did a talk a talk and a reading in conversation with a physicist. I haven't read any of those poems yet, but I have some poems that are engaging with what I know about physics, which is, you know, limited, but I have an interest. And so this physicist named Ben Bushler, who works on, this sounds so interesting, quantum teleportation, agreed to come with me and to this event and listen to some of my physics poems and then talk with me about it afterwards.
Oh.
That was so fantastic. I mean, it was, you know, there was one point where he said, this is actually a great metaphor for something that happens, and that was thrilling. But there was another where he said, I'm not sure you're right about that, but it was great. It was even though he kind of corrected me in public, I still loved it. It was great.
That should be recorded.
It probably has been, but I'm not.
That sounds awesome. To quote a teenager's language, that sounds awesome. To be in colloquy with a physicist.
Mm-hmm.
Betting your poetry and telling you where you are on it. Well, let's hear two together, and then
okay. We'll
have a big hunk of you. Ray,
okay. Why don't I read a physics poem since we were just talking about it?
That'd be great.
Okay, like picture this. Can I go to that? Okay.
I got that.
Okay. Picture this. Particles, whether long or short-lived, arise from a permanent traveling disturbance in a quantum field. But we all know that when a disturbance is permanent, it no longer disturbs. Picture a tent city. One way to think about it is as a kind of tension rippling through space. We know how tension distributes itself in a body, now behind the eyelids, now in the shoulders. How it can be moved but not removed, so that when we suck on our knuckles, our neck muscles can relax briefly. Why so tense, we might wonder? Did God yell, hey, just once, as if testing the acoustics?
Whoa. Well, I've got you. Let's go to another poem.
Okay. I've got another physics poem right under that called In Practice, which is dedicated to the physicist Carlo Rovelli, and because I quote from him, from his book, The Order of Time, in a couple of places here. Okay, In Practice for Carlo Rovelli. Heat cannot pass from a cold body to a hot one. That's it. That's the one law of physics that distinguishes the past from the future with its clutter of burnouts. When what matters is who's wearing the kitty tail right now. Who thinks she knows where meaning is? Just wait. Times are legion, a different one for every point in space, no matter how close, how lonesome.
Whoa, that ending is powerful. The Chicago Review of Books said Armin Trout loses none of her usual playfulness as she insistently probes for meaning in a time of catastrophes. So you approving the point, I always tell my students, read everything, not just poetry, read everything.
Yeah.
So your interest in science shows up, and actually it's a kind of a platform for you.
Yeah, sometimes. And I notice how the God question comes in too. It's not that I'm exactly religious, and it's not that I'm a scientist, but both of those domains deal with the ultimate questions, I guess, how the universe began, how we got here, how things started, how they might end, what's really happening under the surface level. Both science and religion deal with that. So I kind of bring them both in and let them speak to each other.
Oh, you're all about the invisible.
Yeah.
You're all about the invisible. You are connected to all those divine things that you can't see. And that is very clear. That's the stem of your work, I think. So when you won the Pulitzer Prize, that's pretty huge. I mean, that is the most coveted prize given by your peers. That's the important thing, I think. And what were you told then about why it was chosen?
Nothing. This is a funny story, really. Because this was back in the day, back in 2010.
Not that long ago.
Yeah, feels like it to me. But anyway, so you would think that they would have emailed me. You would think that they would have called me, but they didn't. They didn't. They sent me a letter through the mail saying that I had won this. I don't know whether they tried to reach me and couldn't or what, but they sent me a letter. But somehow, I guess it was the winners were put up online. But at that point, I was not expecting to really win anything, so I didn't even know when Pulitzer Prizes were announced. And I certainly never expected that I would win that.
Oh.
So I wasn't looking at it. But my university's publicity office had seen, the woman there had seen it. And so she called me and she assumed, of course, that I knew. And she said, the press are going to want to talk to you. And I went, what? Why? Is my office on fire? I didn't do it. You know? And she said, you don't know, do you? And I'm like, I'm stunned, you know. And
aww.
She said, then she told me. And I kind of yelled for my husband. That was my first response. But I yelled in such a startled, I guess it sounded to him like alarmed voice, that he came running in thinking maybe our son was in the hospital or something. But no, it was that. And that's how
it's big. It's big. It could give you so many reasons to go on. Mm-hmm. Or does it make you more inhibited to start writing again? I mean, you're always working on new material. So did you, after you picked yourself up and brushed yourself off, did it give you impetus that you wanted to keep writing?
I always want to keep writing. I mean, remember that first poem, there's a line in that first poem that I read that goes, but I'm hard to discourage. I think there is a certain amount of pressure that comes with it. At the Pulitzer ceremony, one of the people said to everyone who won that was there, all the winners were at a brunch, right? And one of the organization's people said, now you know, the three words with which your obituary will begin. I went, oh, is that
okay? We could do without that.
Thanks for reminding me of that.
What are you working on now?
Oh, well, I'm writing so much now that I've retired that I have a new book that's been accepted by Wesleyan called Safe Rooms, and it's probably going to come out in 2016, but, you know, we don't have a date yet.
We will definitely make a date in 2016.
And then I'm halfway through
2026, you mean?
Oh, yeah. Yes, 2026. Right.
I'll be there.
Time flies. And then I'm halfway through another manuscript.
Well, let us hear too from Go Figure.
Okay.
Before the other books come out.
Yeah, I know.
Give us a chance.
Okay. I know, right? Okay. Two more. This one has something to do with my granddaughters, and well, you'll see. Sides. They fight about which sides of the compartment the heart and star bandages should be on until one cries for help. In the beginning, chaos sloshed around uneasily. In the other beginning was the word. This is the long side. just so you know, one notes, and it goes downhill from there, goes south, as we used to say, cruelly.
I thought that was puzzling, the cruelly.
Oh.
Yet I can.
I can explain that.
Do you want to remark on that?
Yeah, sure. Well, there is a saying, probably not said as often these days, but it hasn't. If it disappeared, it was only recently, that something has gone south.
Right.
It means kind of like, you know, gone to hell, gone bad. But, you know, south of, I mean, think about the global south. You know, where is this idea? I mean, it's kind of cruel to demonize the south.
I took it that way as well, but I also thought it was used as to spite someone when they say they're going south. It was like an insult. Mm-hmm. So that was where I took the cruelty. And let's have more poetry.
Okay, here's one more. Angel. When I was almost a woman, the men in the radio called someone I thought might be me an angel and a baby. I wasn't offended. What did I know? I knew I would have to empty myself to fit inside the songs, and I wanted to be in them as long as they lived, to be called to and never come, to be full of my lighter and lighter self with literally no place to go, as it is in heaven.
I love that. Is my favorite one. I love that one. It's a little sad.
Yeah,
but it's quite beautiful. You live so far from where you were, San Diego to Everett, Washington.
Yeah.
How do you find your way through all that greenery?
Oh, well, I love it. You know, I love the greenery. Yeah. What I don't like is when the leaves all fall off and then everything.
But I think in Everett, they're always green.
Oh, well, I mean, there are a lot of evergreens. But in Everett, there are also a lot of old deciduous trees that are beautiful. There are maples, there are chestnuts, there are oaks, you know. So, and some of them are really old and they're gorgeous. And also there are, of course, vines and bushes and just lots of things so that you can always look out the window. And if there's sun.
Are you surrounded by some nature?
I wouldn't call it nature, but, well, maybe nature. I'm surrounded by living things. I mean, it's a pretty, you know, it's like a street with houses, but it's got trees, and we have big windows that, with a wisteria vine.
Oh, yes, I love that. That wisteria vine comes right in the house, doesn't it?
Yeah, it will. It will if it can.
Well, I know you're en route somewhere because you're always coming or going. Where are you going now?
Chicago.
And is that a poetry thing?
Yeah, I'm reading for the Poetry Foundation with Daniel Brzezinski and Forrest Sander.
Oh, wonderful. I do know Forrest. Well, may we have a closing poem?
Sure. There was one I left out, so I'll bring it back now. It's kind of back to Disasterville. Flame. In the midst of the evident collapse, I'm bored. What is there left to say? I say. I could make a flame sound like the flick of a lizard's tongue, then like a human skating on a pond of hot wax. I can't say burning oil, but I can make you think it there. Don't think of that old canard, don't think of an elephant. Do you like the word listen? Shall we fall in love with the small, transparent, dancing girl? Call her Tinkerbell?
Do you like the word listen? And the book list says this is classic Armantrout. Poetry fans will want this. And this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. We are funded by the Sinipet Fund, the Rivada Foundation, friends of the program, Natalie Canavort, Sandy Jackson Cohen, and Gene Nordhaus. Mike Turpin's our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.